It's baffled scholars for two millennia. It is a puzzle made of multidimensional elements. An enigma with roots that reach back to the dawning of time, perhaps before. Daniel explained part of it. Ezekiel and Isaiah had glimpses into it. John saw it all for the time of the end. That time is now. Join Derek and Sharon Gilbert on a journey that spans the course of history. From Eden to Mount Hermon. From Hermon to Babel. From Babel to Rome. From Rome to the cross. And from there to us. Biblical prophecy is coming true before your eyes. And to understand it, you must discern the times both then and now. It's time to unravel the threads of this all-encompassing prophetic paradox. It's time to unravel Revelation.
The Four Horsemen of the Apocalypse. Welcome to Unraveling Revelation from Skywatch TV. I'm Derek Gilbert.
I'm Sharon Gilbert, and we have finally arrived. We skipped ahead a few weeks ago because the coronavirus was here, and we decided we needed to discuss those writers. And now, here we are again to unpack it a little more carefully. Revelation 6 is one of those, almost an iconic picture.
Sure.
The Four Horsemen is used by a lot of people who have no idea what it really refers to.
Mm-hmm.
Apocalypse is used by a lot of people that have no idea what it refers to.
Right.
Armageddon, used again almost all the time to refer to the end of the world. Yeah, sort of.
Not exactly.
Not exactly. Yep. An apocalypse, no, that's not the end of the world. That just means unveiling.
Absolutely. So we're going to dig a little deeper into this and analyze it in the context of the research we've been doing, the long-running spiritual war, and especially with the divine council concept in view.
Yeah.
If these entities are out riding, which is how they appear to be, how they're depicted by John, the question then is, who are they?
And who are they? And when did they start?
And when did they start? Right, because a lot of what we know about Revelation, how we analyze end times prophecy, will be reflected in what we make of these four writers and when they started writing.
Well, I'll tell you what. Before we even begin to read, let's recap. When we last left the divine realm, Jesus had just arrived, looking as a lamb who had been slain, and we get this anthropomorphic form of the Father with his right hand extended. Notice it's the right hand, because Christ is the Son of the right hand.
Right.
He has something in his hand that that no one can open.
Right.
And everybody's weeping. And the Lord shows up and he takes it. And I was taught, and this is actually a very common belief in eschatology, that this document, this scroll that is written on the back and the front is a deed.
Mm-hmm.
That the Lord redeemed not only humanity, he redeemed the whole earth, means he bought it back. He paid the price for our sin. It was being held at a big pawnbroker's in hell. Satan owned the rights. Somewhere along the line, Adam had just thrown it away, said, okay, here you can have it. The Lord went in, he redeemed it for us, and now the God the Father is saying, you're the one bought this, it's yours.
Right, right. And this is...
Which is great, because Satan tried to give it to him.
Yes, and said, I'll give it to you if you just bow the knee and worship me.
Yeah.
And Jesus said, we're not doing
that.
Well, and this is why I think the parable of the wicked tenants applies to more than just the Jewish religious leaders who were entrusted with the instruction of God's chosen people. I think that parable applies to the spirit realm, these sons of God, these watcher class entities who were given the responsibility of watching over humanity after Babel, Deuteronomy 32, 8 and 9, when God divided the nations,
right. Yeah,
numbered them according to the number of the sons of God. They didn't rule wisely or justly, Psalm 82, that courtroom scene. Now we're seeing, I think, the consequences of the courtroom scene where God is handing the deed to the only one who is capable of opening it. And We had a number of viewers who sent us emails who said, you know, make sure you emphasize this, because mm-hmm. we didn't really emphasize it enough last week.
Well, but, because I knew we were getting to it this week.
Right.
It is what I was taught when I was 9 years old.
Yeah. See, now I was raised in a church where Revelation was not even, it was not even on the agenda. A liturgical church, we don't deal with it. It's weird. It's basically, it was part of an, we were part of an amillennial denomination.
Yeah.
You know, we're already in the goal, or yeah. it's all symbolic. It doesn't really...
And I think Catholics are amillennial.
Yes, yes. The vast majority of the world's Christians are amillennial. Mm-hmm. So by watching this show, you're in the minority. Welcome to our little exclusive club.
Really
here.
Quickly, for those who don't know what amillennialism is.
Essentially, it means that the millennial reign of Jesus, which is prophesied in Revelation, is taken as symbolic, mm-hmm. that it represents the church age, that we're in the millennium. It's not a literal 1,000 years. It's however long the church age lasts until
Boy,
Jesus comes back and puts it to an
end. This golden age is pretty not golden.
Well, yeah, because
the millennial age is
during the millennial reign, Satan is bound, and it doesn't look like he's bound when you
and
look
Jesus
at...
And Jesus rules
yeah, from,
in.
Right. So you've got... The church denominations, the major denominations, have been teaching for almost 2,000 years that that's the case, that we're either to understand it symbolically, metaphorically, or that we're already in the millennial reign.
May I just remind everybody that for most of church history, the average believer did not read.
Or was not didn't have access to a Bible in their own language.
Yes. But most of the Bibles were written in Greek or Latin.
Right.
And they, most people did, they could not read. They weren't taught to read. So they heard. Mm-hmm. The lessons were taught to them. And they if they could read, they generally only had a prayer book their own language.
And think about it. It really wasn't until the 17th century when you started seeing English language translations, as late as the 16th century, during the time of King Henry VIII, you know, having the scriptures in English could get you killed.
Mm-hmm.
So it's really just the last quarter or so of the church age where the lay people like us have had access to scriptures in our own language.
Exactly. So you've got a lot of people that weren't aware there was a book of Revelation
mm-hmm.
because they didn't have their own Bible. And even now, those who do have access to their own, let's say you're a Catholic or another amillennial...
Mainline Protestant denomination. Most of them don't teach
it. You're told to ignore it.
Right, right.
This is all metaphor.
Yeah. So it's weird. It's disturbing. It's scary. It will...
All the more reason why you need to read it.
That's right. If it's in the Bible and it's weird, it's important.
Dig in.
Right. Well, that was why the weeping in heaven that John saw, when it was nobody can redeem the deed and redeem the earth from Satan, the god of this world, the prince of the earth, the prince mm-hmm. of this world. Revelation chapter 6 begins. Now I watched when the Lamb opened one of the seven seals, and I heard one of the four living creatures, one of the cherubim, say with a voice like thunder, "Come." And in the King James, it's "Come and see."
You know, honestly, John. He is in a very scary place, hearing this very scary creature shout this word, "Come."
Yes.
And it sounds like thunder.
What's interesting is...
Which is another aspect of this whole...
Right. What's also interesting is that the difference between this in the English Standard Version and the King James, "Come and see."
Yes, exactly.
It's implied that what he's saying is directed at John, "Come and see."
Yes.
But here, when he's saying, "A voice like thunder, come," it's like they're saying to the rider on the white horse, "Now's the time to ride."
Exactly. I've always wondered about that, because clearly there's a command given to the rider. And I always wondered, between these two, what it meant. That's another one of those need to speak native Greek in order to really dig in ancient Greek.
Right, right. Verse 2, "And I looked, and behold, a white horse, and its rider had a bow, and a crown was given to him, and he came out conquering and to conquer."
Okay, got to stop, because mm-hmm. there's a lot in here.
Right. Again, this is one of those things where you can understand a lot about what somebody believes about end times prophecy by how they identify the rider on the white horse.
Yeah.
We Americans thinking rider, white horse, must be good.
Or Gandalf. Could be Gandalf.
Could be Gandalf. But later in the prophecy, we see that Jesus is riding the white horse. But
not here.
Not here.
This is the imitation.
That's correct. I would also suggest this, that the opening of the seals and then the later judgments that we see, the trumpets and the bowls, mm-hmm. are not necessarily given to us in sequential order. In other words, there may be a lot of overlap, and we'll dig more into that when we get into the trumpets and the bowls.
Right. In other words, the stuff that happens later doesn't necessarily happen after all of chapter 6 is done.
Exactly. There's some overlap mm-hmm. here.
In some ways, chapter 6 is like an outline.
Yes, an outline of what is to come, mm-hmm. but also things that have already happened. Now,
well, exactly. The first big question is who this is, but when this is, mm-hmm. is also very important. When I first started studying eschatology as a 9-year-old, I was told that this had not happened yet.
Mm-hmm.
I've come to the conclusion that it probably happened right after Christ ascended.
Mm-hmm.
Because he appears to have just arrived in heaven.
Right.
And this rider is given a crown of victory.
Yeah. Now, there are those, and see, this is interesting, because those who take a preterist or partial preterist view will look at the rider on the white horse and argue that it was Nero or the Roman emperors in general or Constantine, but it's already been fulfilled.
I think he was just one of the many, you know, who were part of this spiritual activity that...
Right.
that are led by the spirit entity, not a human entity,
right.
a spirit entity on this horse. And I think that the victory crown is one that was given to him. We don't know who gives it to him.
That's true. It doesn't say.
It just says was given to him.
Mm-hmm.
And he came out conquering and to conquer. This entity, I believe, is the spirit of Antichrist that Paul wrote about, and at the very least.
Mm-hmm.
But he appears to think he's won. Oh, look.
Right.
He came down as a human. We crucified him. Now he's run away.
And the crown that he was given is a crown of victory, as you say, a Stephanos, as opposed to a diademos. Which is a crown of royalty. So, all right, he's got a crown of victory. I think, and a futurist view would be, of course, that this is the spirit of Antichrist. But if we look at him riding as soon as or shortly after Jesus appears in heaven as the Lamb who was slain,
uh-huh.
and we look at this from the divine counsel perspective, we can also say, you know, offer another possible identification mm-hmm. for this entity. He's got a bow,
yes.
and he comes out conquering and to conquer. This could be Apollo or Apollyon.
That's entirely possible, but I just want to back up. You had said it may not be the spirit of Antichrist, but we know Paul said spirit of Antichrist was already there.
Right.
Already existed. So spirit of Antichrist is not a future thing.
No, true.
The actual Antichrist, the human who's inhabited by Satan, that is a future thing.
Mm-hmm.
But this may also be Reshef.
Yes, and Reshef is the ancient entity known as a plague god, a horse archer.
And he may be Apollo. We just don't know that they are exactly the same entity.
Well, there's good evidence to suggest from the island of Cyprus, where he was venerated by the Greeks and the Semites.
I know. The reason I'm saying this, I don't want people to get confused, because those of you who've been studying this for a while, you're going, wait a minute, Apollyon doesn't come out until the abyss is opened. That hasn't happened yet.
Right, right.
So we're not saying this is Apollyon. I'm not saying it's Apollyon.
Okay.
I'm saying it's perhaps a gatekeeper figure
mm-hmm.
who is in charge of a whole bunch of spirits, and he and his buddies get to start riding. And, of course, we see the last one that comes out is hell.
Yeah, right, right. And that's something we'll get into when we dig into Revelation 9 a little bit more, whether or not Apollyon is actually in the abyss. He's called the king over those who are in the abyss. And
yes.
The implication is that he's in the abyss.
Exactly. But he may not be. And that's why I want to bring this up, because I know
right.
a lot of you are going to go, wait a minute, wait a minute, wait a minute.
Too many names, too fast.
Okay, stop for a minute. Let's talk about Reshef after the break, because most people have never heard of him.
Yeah, we'll discuss why this entity is important and the long history of conflict between God and Reshef when Unraveling Revelation continues.
near-death experiences and extraordinary accounts of angelic intervention as told by those who experience them. It's time to comprehend these often chilling, intimidating, and sometimes completely misunderstood subjects. SkyWatch TV is proud to announce the Life After Death Official Collection. In this incredible collection, you'll receive the brand new book by Donna Howell and Ali Anderson Henson, Encounters, where you'll learn whether holy angels can default from God's army, have wings, or read our minds. The biblical answer to whether we should attempt to beckon angels to carry out our requests or seek them out as spirit guides. You'll also learn about the fierce capacity of angels, their strength in spiritual warfare, and ability to operate in the physical world to carry out God's prophetic will. All this and so much more. You'll also receive the brand new book by Donna Howell, Ali Anderson Henson, and Josh Peck, Afterlife, where you'll discover for the first time real-life stories of near-death and out-of-body experiences as told by those who experience them. What scientists say about evidence of life in the beyond. Surprising implications made through the Shroud of Turin. And tackles tough questions like, if God is such a loving God, why does he send people to hell for all of eternity? This masterpiece collection also includes the incredible DVD, Beyond Supernatural, which features stunning off-the-record interviews with Josh Peck and Stephen Bancars detailing their long history of involvement in the New Age and their personal testimonies of deliverance by Jesus Christ. All that and more on this original SkyWatch TV 5-part series on DVD that exposes the infiltration of the New Age. But that's not all. This powerhouse collection also includes the popular audio series Doctrines of Devils. Listen as Stephen Bancars interviews Doreen Virtue, world-renowned former best-selling author and teacher for the New Age, as she explains her incredible supernatural journey out of the occult and into the arms of Jesus. This over 12-hour series features bonus interviews with Dr. Chuck Missler, Dr. Thomas Horn, John McTernan, Gary Bates, and many more on the subjects of ghosts, demons, and the supernatural. Sold separately, these items hold a retail value of $110. Yours now for your donation of only $35 plus shipping and handling. Someone you know is asking questions right now about the afterlife. Everything you need to know is explained in the Life After Death Official Collection. Available now at SkyWatchTVStore.com. Order now or call 1-844-750-4985.
Welcome back to Unraveling Revelation from SkyWatch TV. I'm Derek Gilbert.
I'm Sharon Gilbert, and we would love, love, love for you to join us in Israel in October.
There's an
easy website that is SkyWatch TV.
SkyWatch in Israel.
SkyWatch in Israel. SkyWatchInIsrael.com. Go there, and it will tell you everything you need to know. We're going to Israel. There's an extension going to the island of Sardinia, which has a ziggurat and all sorts of giant tombs on it that you are going to be amazed at. And if you've already been to Israel, you don't want to do that, but you do want to go to Sardinia, there's a separate Sardinia tour in October. So we're going to be there for a while.
Yeah. So SkyWatchInIsrael.com and join us. And you can find out more, in fact, by watching the web-exclusive broadcast with Aaron Lipkin, which is available right now from SkyWatch TV. All of our usual web-exclusive locations, Roku, Apple TV, Amazon Fire Stick. It's on YouTube. It's on our mobile app, which is a free download. You can find that in the top menu bar at SkyWatchTV.com.
Is it on SkyWatchInIsrael.com?
I don't think the interview is there, but you'll find it on all of the SkyWatch TV. Every place you find SkyWatch TV broadcasts.
We'll put it there. We'll make sure it's there.
Yeah.
We'll make it easy for you.
Anyway, you'll find that there, and hope you can join us in Israel for the tour. One of the places you'll see on the tour, in fact, is the city sacred to Reshef, which today is called Nablus.
Yeah.
In the ancient world, it was called Shechem.
Yes. We were facing that while we were standing on Mount Ebal.
Yes. So Reshef was an entity worshipped in the ancient world 1,000 years before the Exodus. And it's known from ancient texts from this city Ebla in northern Syria near Aleppo from about 2400 BC that one of the cities sacred to Reshef was the city of Shechem. Well, Shechem was where Abraham was visited at the Oak of Moreh, which is on a hill overlooking Shechem.
Yes. Isn't it right about in there, too, where the teraphim were buried?
Yes.
That came to that Rachel stole from her father?
Right. Jacob's well was in that city. It's where Joseph is buried. And it is...
Teraphim are the statues, the little
household gods, right. Yeah. And it's also where Joshua's altar is located.
Yeah.
So something unique about that particular city and about that particular entity, because God directed Joshua and the Israelites, once they destroyed Jericho and then defeated the city of Ai, they traveled north to Shechem and set up the altar there on Mount Ebal, overlooking Shechem, the city sacred to Resheph, and declared there, "As for me and my house, we will serve the Lord." Resheph also, I mean, he was a very popular deity in the ancient world, and he's mentioned in the Bible more often than you think, but it's usually not translated as his name. It's usually translated plague. But there is there's a description of the plagues of hailstones that afflicted the cattle in Egypt in one of the Psalms, and the word in Hebrew is actually Reshephim, which suggests that there was more than one Resheph.
As if it's a type of entity.
Yes. I speculate on that in Last Clash of the Titans. There's also a city in Lebanon today, I believe it was Sidon, where one quarter of the city was called Land of the Reshephs, Land of the Reshephim. Well, his worship spread, his cult spread into Egypt, and even after the Canaanites, who were ruling northern Egypt during the time of Jacob and Joseph, were pushed out by the native Egyptians and the native pharaohs took back over, Pharaoh Amenhotep II adopted Resheph as his personal protector god. And this was a little detail that I pieced together. There's a scholarly paper by an archaeologist by the name of Douglas Petrovich, who has done some excellent work. In fact, he's been interviewed by Timothy Mahoney. He was interviewed for the Moses controversy whether or not there was a language or an alphabet that Moses could have used to write the books of Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, etc. Anyway, Dr. Petrovich wrote this paper and I think proved the case that Amenhotep II was the pharaoh of the Exodus. Well, Amenhotep II adopted this god as his personal protector god, especially in battle. Because not only was he the plague god who spread plague with his arrows, he was the chariot warrior god, the special protector of chariot warriors. And God, Yahweh, freed his people from this pharaoh by sending a bunch of plagues and then destroying his chariot corps. And then they brought, you know, once they got into the Holy Land 40 years later, set up the altar there above the city of Resheph to declare that they would serve Yahweh. Now, again, Resheph was identified as Apollo on the island of Cyprus, and the confusion is whether Apollo is to be identified as Apollyon, because Apollo is a diminutive form of Apollyon.
Right.
So that we don't know.
Really
don't have enough
to
evidence
know.
To say for sure.
Is this also possible? Is it also possible that this is the ancient god Nergal?
Yes. Identified as Nergal. And like Nergal, Resheph, and Apollo, they were all considered gatekeepers to the underworld, which is why...
Just really quickly, these are probably the same spirit entity with different names.
Correct. So worshipped in ancient Babylon as Nergal, worshipped by the Canaanites and Amorites around Israel as Resheph, worshipped by the Greeks and the Romans as Apollo. And interestingly, we know that the Greeks and the Romans had different names for most of their gods, you know, Zeus, Jupiter, et cetera, et cetera. Apollo was the only one worshipped under the same name by the Greeks and the Romans. He was one of the most important deities to the Greeks and the Romans.
And as we discovered when we studied the seven churches and the seven letters, every one of those cities had a temple to Apollo.
To Apollo and to Artemis.
And to Artemis, his sister.
Right. So I think there's a good case to be made for this rider on the white horse being Resheph / Apollo. The question which we'll wrestle with when we get to Revelation 9 is whether Apollo and Apollyon are the same.
That's true.
As we don't know.
That's true. Okay, so let's read 2 again. "And I looked and behold a white horse, and its rider had a bow." Now, I think it's understood that if you have a bow, you've got arrows. I remember when I was studying it as a 9 and 10-year-old that the pastor said, "You don't see an arrow mentioned in here, so it could be that he's not a very powerful." And I don't know how, I don't think so. I think that it's understood. "And a crown was given to him, and he came conquering." If you're going out to conquer, if you're stealing peace from the earth, with only a bow and no arrows, you're I don't know how you're managing to do it.
Yes.
I guess you're a Democrat. And a crown was given to him, and he came out conquering and to conquer. When he opened, he, Christ, opened the second seal, I heard the second living creature say, come, or in the KJV, mm-hmm. come and see. And you read,
and out came another horse, bright red. Its rider was permitted to take peace from the earth so that people should slay one another, and he was given a great sword. I would argue that this is the war god.
Mm-hmm.
That this would be Ares or Mars to the Greeks and Romans. But interestingly, and I go into this in Bad Moon Rising, that Ares to the Greeks was identified in older days as the national god of the Moabites, Chemosh.
Oh.
And Chemosh was also worshipped alongside Reshef at the ancient city of Ebla. This is a very ancient entity worshipped under as different names, under different names in different places.
I think the big thing to remember is that these are all entities. We're only given the name of
right.
one. That's Thanatos.
Right.
So we're giving that in the, given that in the Greek because we're it's being written in Greek.
Mm-hmm.
And that's so that all the churches would understand it, because the whole world had been Hellenized practically, a whole known world.
Right.
I would say that all of these entities have names, and all of these entities think that they are in charge.
Right.
But they're being used.
Right. And we will get into that more when we get into around Revelation 16, the woman riding on the beast, because you made an excellent presentation last fall at the Skywatch TV Defender Conference on the identity of the woman on the beast. Interestingly, and we'll have to get into this next week as we pick up the second seal again, I argue in Bad Moon Rising that Chemosh, Ares, Mars is actually just another aspect of Inanna.
I so agree with that. Inanna is sort of a gender fluid. Jewed Flinder.
Yes. That too.
She's but
but I liked your explanation of it, how these entities can manifest as different genders and different names in different places. Like, look, they're operating in more dimensions than we are. Imagine somebody, you know, manipulating finger puppets, and we can only see the puppets. We can't see the hand operating them behind.
Exactly. One more thing. The word that is translated as bow is toxon.
Right.
We get toxic from that. You get this idea of something poisonous, which
right.
I think also points to Reshef.
Yes, because of his spreading of the plague.
Yes.
Through most
using
people,
arrows.
Right. Most of us who study Greek mythology in school don't remember that aspect of Apollo's personality. And it's mm-hmm. certainly not the one that's being spread through the young adult fiction that's being marketed to kids.
No, not at all.
But Apollo was definitely considered a god who was not always good.
And I think given the current crisis in the world, the coronavirus epidemic and probably pandemic at this point,
yep.
I think identifying that bow as a toxic form of weapon is absolutely correct. Plague, yeah. God indeed.
And there are multiple levels of that too. GMO foods and...
Well, we'll get into that yeah. next week. Maybe we'll need to finish, you know, just keep talking about this first rider.
Oh, and I foolishly thought we might get through all four riders this week.
Never going to happen.
Well, we continue with the second seal next week, and we thank you for watching. This is Unraveling Revelation from Skywatch TV.